You want the mic? Oh, okay.
We'll be taking questions.
Is there a mic back there?
The mic wasn't functioning properly. We had to bring the whole thing. So we're just going to ask for people if you can project. We have any questions?
Okay, you better stay up here because I don't really...
We have written questions.
Okay, I don't hear very well, so you'll have to translate them for me. Hmm? I don't really hear well, so you'll have to repeat them for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we have questions from the next room over, from the overflow room, and we can start with those. Mr. Chomsky, please describe briefly the difference between Judaism and Zionism.
Between what?
Between Judaism and Zionism.
Nothing to do with each other. I mean, my grandfather was a ultra-Orthodox Jew. He lived in Baltimore most of his life, but I think he still thought he was in the Ukraine, frankly. I was literally, and was wondering why the peasants were black, you know, but it's no joke, but... it's part of the kind of transplanted Eastern European Jewry fled from Eastern Europe during the pogroms in the early part of last century. He wasn't a Zionist. He never heard of Zionism. In fact, you go back to, say, the First World War, I think maybe 1% of the Jewish population of the world had what's called a shekel, a Zionist membership in the Zionist organization. The United States... here, most of the population, the Jewish population, was sort of pro-Zionist in a sort of an interesting sense. So, for example, Louis Brandeis, who's one of the great heroes of the Zionist movement, great humanist, important legal figure, he was very much in favor of the Balfour Declaration. But the reasons are that he felt that the Balfour Declaration would direct Eastern European Jews to Palestine, so they wouldn't come here. And he didn't want these dirty Eastern European Jews, like my parents, for example, to come to the United States, where there was an elite Jewish community. We don't want those guys. And that continues. He was a Zionist in that sense. And that continued after the Second World War. It's not discussed very much, but one of the really ugly periods, which I'm old enough to remember very well as activist at that time. After the Second World War, the death camps ended, so no crematoria. But plenty of people were living in, the Jews were living in the concentration camps under horrible conditions. Actually, Truman actually sent an emissary to inspect the conditions. His reports were awful. Well, very few of those people came here. And they didn't come here for a couple of reasons. The one reason is the American Jewish community didn't want them. They wanted them to go to Palestine, not here. And there were a lot of reasons for that. The one reason was there was anti-Semitism at the time. I grew up with it, and they didn't want more of it. And another is, you know, they're just not the kind of people we want around here in our community. So they were Zionists in that sense, send them to Palestine. And that was considered extremely humane. It was very humane to get them to go to Palestine, somebody else's country, but not bring them here. Would they have wanted to come here? Well, you know, we don't really know, but you know, half of Europe would have wanted to come here in those days if they had a chance. And I don't doubt that people in, you know, miserable conditions in concentration camps would. In fact, probably more Latvian Nazis got here in the late 40s than Jews from the concentration camps. So yes, they were Zionists in that sense, but until 1967, Zionism was not a huge issue in the Jewish community. In fact, like journals like, say, Commentary, you know, ultra extreme jingoist pro-Israel journal, until 1967, it was mostly non-Zionist. The Norman Podhoretz, you know, the editor who's now extreme. He wrote a book and came out in 1967. He never even mentioned Israel, his own history. And it was that way across the board. It just wasn't much of an issue. In 1967, it changed. A lot of reasons. One of them was what I mentioned, but there's more. So now, yes, now it's true that for a large part of the Jewish community, Zionism is like the religion. But that's... it's new and it's thin and it's limited. And among younger Jews, it's actually disappearing, seriously declining. And the Zionist leaders are concerned about it. As polls and so on show that. Just the normal liberal attitudes of young Jews are not consistent with what's going on there. But they're different. You know, you can be you can be a non-Jewish Zionist. Christian Zionism is way older than Jewish Zionism and much deeper. We tend to forget that, but Christian Zionism in Britain and the United States particularly was a very powerful force, very powerful. Remember, these are very religious societies, the United States in particular, but Britain too. These are real fundamentalist societies. Like in the United States, about a third of the population believes that every word of the Bible is literally true. That's why, and you know, like two-thirds are expecting the second coming. And you know, that's why half the population thinks the world was created a couple thousand years ago, exactly the way it is now. And why, you know, one of the heads of the subcommittees in Congress just announced that we don't have to worry about global warming because God promised Noah that there wouldn't be another flood. This would be funny if it was happening in some small, insignificant country, but not in the richest and most powerful country in the world. About a quarter of Republicans think Obama's Antichrist. It's a very strange country. This country is kind of like off the wall. And it's been that way a long time. And it's not Christian, it's not the Christian right. It's not just evangelicals, it's the mainstream. People like Woodrow Wilson, for example. So, for example, when the British general Allenby conquered Jerusalem during the First World War, you take a look at the headlines of the national press, you know, like Washington Post. They were saying Richard the Lionhearted finally drove the pagans out of the Holy Land. Allenby's Richard the Lionhearted. He drove out the pagans, brought the Holy Land back to us. Well, that's the liberal mainstream. And of course, the Holy Book says after the Holy Land comes back to us, God's commandment is that the Jews have to go there. Harold Ickes, who was one of Roosevelt's main advisors, you know, liberal, secular advisor, described the return of the Jews to Palestine then as one of the greatest achievements of history, because it was fulfilling God's will. And that goes right to the present. Well, that's Christian Zionism. It's a large part of the reason why, you know, the connection between Israel and the United States, Britain, too. So you can be a Christian Zionist, you can be a Jewish non-Zionist. I mean, they're anti-Zionist, you know, they're different notions.
Another question. What implications does the death of Bin Laden have on the issue of Palestine? What does it mean to the resistance to the occupation?
Practically nothing, I think. Frankly, I mean, you know, Bin Laden didn't amount to anything. He amounted to a lot in the American imagination and demonology, but he almost nothing to do with what's going on in the world. He was, you know, hidden away somewhere in Afghanistan. Pakistan, actually. Whatever Al-Qaeda is, it isn't a membership organization where you take orders from the top. It's called, you know, specialists who work on it call it a network of networks, kind of loosely affiliated groups, mostly local, independent.
Run by the CIA and Mossad.
It's not run by the CIA and Mossad. No, please. No, it's not. But they're all over. They're pretty well studied. And a very good book by Scott Atran. It goes through a lot of it. A lot of them are just based on communities, you know, same soccer club, things like that. And they carry out their own operations. Bin Laden was a kind of symbolic figure, so, you know, people listen to his orations and so on, but and besides, increasingly they were becoming marginalized. What happened in the last year or so sort of almost totally marginalized them. What's going on in the Arab Spring is really significant. It essentially drove what there is of jihadism into the corner. Nobody cares about it anymore. Why the United States decided to assassinate him at this point, and it was an assassination, remember. They've now conceded it was a straight murder of an unarmed, defenseless man. They didn't try to capture him. You take a look at the details, they almost certainly could have. But they didn't want to capture him. They dumped him in the ocean so nobody would find out what happened to him. This is all internal to U.S. ideology. It has nothing much what's going on in the world. The chances are they didn't want to capture him because if they did, they'd have had to bring him to trial, and that would have been a disaster because they really had no evidence. And they've conceded it a long time ago. Now, years ago, the FBI conceded that they had suspicions and beliefs, and the beliefs are probably correct, but beliefs that are probably correct don't stand up in court. But they had no evidence. And so it's best to murder him and get rid of him and have celebrations in Times Square and have a jingoist. But I think it has almost nothing to do with what's going on in Palestine.
One more question. So unity between Hamas and Fatah is a positive step, but now how far can it go given the revelations of the leaked Palestine papers?
Well, there was a lot of talk about the Palestine papers. I wasn't that impressed myself. I thought we mostly knew everything that was in there. What the Palestine papers showed was that the Palestine Authority was, almost desperate to get anything. They were offered nothing, and they kept pushing, well, give us this, give us that. They were treated with total contempt by Israel and by the United States. So you read the statements of Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton, they're just kind of contemptuous. What are you guys bothering us for? But that we knew, that's normal imperialist racism. It showed up here too. But I didn't, well, others disagree, but I wasn't. I mean, that's one of the reasons I never wrote about them. I don't think they meant much.
Now we'll be taking questions
from the audience.
You don't have too much time, so if you have a question. I saw you read with you for a while, so you project.
What's Israel's stand on the no-fly zone of Libya?
Over Libya?
Yeah.
They would go along with... Yeah. What's Israel's stance on the no-fly zone over Libya? They would go along with the U.S. on this. They don't like Gaddafi. In fact, notice it's not a no-fly zone. We should be careful about that. The UN did call for a no-fly zone, but there are three countries who are implementing it as token participation by others, but it's basically Britain, France, and the United States. That's the three traditional imperial powers. The imperial triumvirate picked up the wording of the no-fly zone, appealed to the fact that the Arab League... asked for it. The Arab League almost immediately backed down when they saw what they're doing, and they immediately interpreted it as a justification for participation with the on the rebel side. Now, you can say that's right, you can say it's wrong, say what you like, but it wasn't a no-fly zone. So there was a ceasefire imposed on the government, but not imposed on the rebels. And so when the rebels broke out of Benghazi and moved to the west and took Briga and other towns, they were backed by NATO, no-fly zone. But the participation on the side of the rebels, Israel would probably more or less go along with. I mean, they probably don't care that much.
Also, can we also keep all questions from here on out related to Israel and Palestine, to the topic at hand? And we won't be taking two more questions. So. I know you had your hand up, so you can go ahead.
Nosky, what similarities do you see between what's gone on in Palestine and what's gone on in Kashmir?
What similarities do you see about what's going on in Palestine parallel to what's going on in Kashmir?
If any.
Well, Kashmir is probably the most militarized part of the world. There's a huge Indian army there, very brutal, very repressive. On the other side, Pakistan's been carrying out its own terrorist activities. But the contested parts of Kashmir, the ones under Indian control, are very brutally handled. I mean, long history. I mean, it goes back to the partition. You know, the at the time of the partition, Britain divided the countries. Kashmir was mostly Muslim, but it had a Hindu prince who was running it. And the UN had called for a referendum, which would have voted either for independence or for joining Pakistan. India wouldn't allow it, so they never had a referendum. They kind of controlled it fairly brutally for years. In 1988, I think it was, they allowed an election, which was totally a fake election, you know, which caused great indignation. And there was an uprising, and India came down like a ton of bricks and killed tens of thousands of people and sent in a huge army, which is still there. As I said, it's probably the most militarized part of the world and very brutal. A lot of atrocities going on and all sorts of things. It's a harder situation to settle than Palestine-Israel. I mean, Israel-Palestine, it's pretty clear what the short-term settlement can be. That's the international consensus that the U.S. has been blocking. Kashmir, it's harder. But I think there are possibilities, you know, some settlement along the line of control, you know, with Pakistan, India, and some kind of referendum in the valley, you know. But it would be, I mean, India is just not ready for it. We should pressure them to do it, I think, because it's quite an ugly situation. Let him have the onus.
You were really struggling, so it's...
Do you see new media and social media as powerful for bringing about change in Palestine as it has in other parts of in the region?
Social media? I mean, they have a role. They certainly had a role in the uprisings. Just how big a role we could... argue. First of all, we should remember, it's not very much reported here, but these uprisings didn't come out of nowhere. They've been going on for years. So take Egypt again, the most important country. The January 25th movement, you know, the young people who kind of organized the January 5th demonstration, the tech-savvy young people with the social media and Twitter and stuff, they called themselves the April 6th movement. There was a reason for that. April 6th 2008 was the date of a planned labor action, major labor action. The Egyptian unions have been struggling for years. And they had usually crushed. They had planned major strike actions, calling for, you know, minimal wage and stuff like that. On April 6, 2008, there were solidarity demonstrations. The U.S.-backed dictatorship came in and smashed them by force. Well, you know, we don't pay any attention. It's our dictator, Mubarak doctrine, who cares? But the Egyptians remembered, and the movement was the April 6th movement. And in fact, participation of the labor movement in the uprising was a significant factor in it. So yes, there were social media, but there were a lot of other things. A lot's been going on in all of these countries. In Palestine, there's, you know, in this whole region, North Africa, basically the Arab world, there are two countries which are under foreign military occupation, and one of them is never talked about. That's Western Sahara. It's rather similar to Palestine, and that's where it started. This latest wave started last November with the nonviolent demonstrations in Western Sahara. Tent cities and so on. It's under Moroccan military occupation. Western Sahara is the last colony in Africa. It's under UN jurisdiction. It was supposed to be get autonomy in 1975. And Morocco invaded. Harsh, brutal invasion, the usual thing. They also sent in lots of people. A lot of Moroccans were sent to Western Sahara to try to overwhelm the population. There have been all kind of UN orders not to do it and so on, but Morocco is protected primarily by France. That's the old French, you know, they're the ones who run the dictatorships there, but also by the United States. So Morocco is protected, and when they want to crush a demonstration, nobody says anything. And the other is Palestine. In Palestine, it's the other place in the whole region where there was very little, there were almost no uprisings. They're under tight military control. Maybe things will happen, but they're pretty demoralized, I think. The unification is important, and the tsunami is important, but we'll see.
Yeah, we could take maybe one more question. Okay, I'm gonna trust you though.
No, it's okay, Dr. Shansky, can I ask you to put on your linguist hat for a moment and comment on the use of language and words by the pro-Israel policy lobby and how the phrases that they choose to use to describe the conflict shape the view that the world has of the conflict and our perception of what the possible solutions are. Like, for example, one of the terms that I heard you use, you yourself use, was the term pro-Israel, which is baffling to me, because when I read the Israeli constitution, I see comments about equality and justice for all. So I'm completely baffled as to how people who advocate for apartheid and discrimination are allowed to take over the term pro-Israel when they're obviously opposed to the very principles that Israel was founded on, and yet they take this term and we let them have it, and it kind of gives them legitimacy to, you know. So can I get you to comment on that?
Can you hear? Can you hear? Okay. You didn't, I'm sure you didn't catch much.
What?
You didn't catch much of it.
I didn't catch much of it.
Yeah.
He didn't catch much of it. You're going to have to, also for the people in the other room, can you come here and make it concise, the question. Concise.
Yeah.
Could I ask you to comment on the use of language that the Israeli lobby uses and how they use certain terms and certain phrases to define the perception that the world has of the conflict and how that's kind of a mechanism of control? Specifically, one of the terms that drives me up the wall.
Wait, what kind of term?
Yeah, well, specifically, one of the terms that I heard you use that drives me up the wall is the term pro-Israel. We've allowed these people who are in favor of the Israeli policy, which is isolating Israel and sending it over the cliff of the international isolation, to take over the term saying that they're pro-Israel. And
No, I agree with you. In fact, all right, let's talk about AIPAC. he mentioned AIPAC, so I'm not introducing it. He mentioned the Israeli lobby. And how the Israeli lobby uses terms like, say, pro-Israel. Yeah, I basically agree with you, and I've been writing about it for 35 years. And my view, and I'll just repeat what I've been writing. The people who call themselves pro-Israel, I think, are the people who are dedicated to Israel's moral degeneration and ultimate destruction. Literally. And they may not think so. But when you go back to 1971, you know, and they had a choice, and they've had a choice ever since, a security or expansion. If you're against security and in favor of expansion, you're not in favor of the people of Israel. You're in favor of their destruction, because that's going to happen. Either the moral degeneration, which is very striking. I mean, what's going on in the country is shocking. I mean, it's to the point where the head of the Israeli Bar Association, you know, conservative lawyer, wrote an article recently in the main journal, Haaretz, in Hebrew, unfortunately, in which he warned of the coming fascism in Israel. It's his term, fascism. He said, we're becoming a fascist state. That's pretty strong words, you know. And you can see what he's talking about. Well, if that's what you want for Israel, okay, support it. But I wouldn't call that pro-Israel. I think your point is right. As for the lobby, there is a lobby. It's a powerful lobby. But think about it for a minute. I mean, the most, in the press, let's say, I won't use the word pro-Israel because your comment is correct, but the journal that most strongly supports Israeli actions and crimes is the Wall Street Journal, by far. much more so than the other mainstream press. I mean, is that part of the lobby? They're the Journal of the Business Community. Of the two political parties, the one that's most rabid in support of Israel's policy is the Republicans. Most of the money and the Jewish money and votes goes to the Democrats. But it's the Republicans that are the most extreme. And in fact, AIPAC's an important lobby, undoubtedly. But, you know, it doesn't begin to compare with the business lobbies, even with the military lobby. I mean, the military lobby just dwarfs AIPAC. And they like what Israel's doing. And so take, say, Lockheed Martin. You're an executive of Lockheed Martin. You think Israel's great. When the U.S. sells F-35s to Israel, that goes into the pockets of Lockheed Martin. Furthermore, it's what's called in the retail trade a teaser. You sell advanced armaments to Israel, and Saudi Arabia, where they have a lot of money, comes along, and they say, we want something too. So what you do is sell second-rate arms to Saudi Arabia, which they have no way of using. In fact, Obama just made a $60 billion deal of arms to Saudi Arabia, the biggest effort ever. You know, so that's great. You know, Britain does the same thing. Sell them arms that recycles petrodollars, helps the U.S. Treasury, helps the armaments industry, and meanwhile it strengthens our, our cop on the beat, the Military Strategic Alliance. AIPAC has very little to do with this. And when, in fact, Israel tries to do something that the U.S. doesn't like, AIPAC just runs for cover. They're smarter than to stand up against U.S. power. So, for example, Israel's economy is very largely military-based, high-tech military, and they have to export. And the big market they'd love to export to is China. And they've tried several times to sell advanced armaments to China. Every single time, the U.S. has just clamped down and said, you can't do it. In fact, George Bush, number two, in 2005, when Israel tried to do it over his objections, the Bush administration not only stopped them, but it went out of its way to humiliate Israel. They refused to allow high-level Israeli military officials to come to the United States. They insisted on an apology from Israel, which, of course, they gave. You didn't hear a peep out of AIPAC. I mean, AIPAC's important. You know, it's a big lobby. So is the Indian lobby. Talk about Kashmir. The Indian lobby in the United States is pretty strong. It's probably the major lobby, also very right-wing. It's probably the major ethnic lobby after AIPAC, and they have an influence, but not when they run into core U.S. power. U.S. policy is not determined by ethnic lobbies. They're okay as long as they work more or less within the framework of the power system. But if they started running against the interests of, say, the business community, they'd be smashed in no time. In fact, people who believe in the significance of AIPAC, I don't diminish it. It's an important lobby. But if you really think that they're running U.S. policy and that say, Mearsheimer and Walt, they're harming U.S. interests, whatever that means. There's a tactic that you ought to pursue. And interestingly, nobody pursues it. What you ought to do is stop all the things we're doing, organizing meetings, protests, activities, all a waste of time. What you should do is put on your ties and jackets, go to the offices of Intel, the Chamber of Commerce, Lockheed Martin, and explain to them politely that their interests are being harmed by an ethnic lobby that they can put out of business in 5 seconds. Okay, that ought to solve the whole problem.
The war on terror is ethnic, it's racist.
I'm sorry,
I didn't. Do you still support the racist 9/11 lies? The boogeyman, Osama bin Goldstein? Do you still believe that?
Do I believe? Yeah. Okay.
What's up, dude? I think we're off the topic.